Thanks for joining us for another episode of the State of the Arts podcast. This time, we sit down with Darren Emerson, a VR artist who's been working with the medium for years, building artworks that are part film, part documentary, part interactive game, but very much original for their use of virtual reality technology. I interviewed Darren after I'd seen his VR artwork called In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats, a piece about the acid house scene in Coventry, which takes audiences on a journey across the city for one night in 1999, looking at the history and the experience of raving. The piece was published in 2021 and was exhibited at FACT in Liverpool in 2023. Darren and I spoke about the state of virtual reality today and how it could affect the future of art. We also chatted about the making of In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats and what makes this piece so successful. I cannot recommend it enough, and you can read our full review of the artwork on the State of the Arts website at the moment. This was another fantastic chat about where our culture is heading, and I hope you enjoy listening back. So yeah, I want to talk a little bit about VR and art and some of the other things I left the piece thinking about, which were profoundly about medium and experience and where this whole stuff is going. VR is maybe in a little bit of a strange place at the moment with, you know, Meta feels like it's having like a midlife crisis, if that makes sense. It's like there's layoffs and there's uncertainty about what their kind of overall direction is, but there's also, well, are we getting the popularity in VR that maybe was expected or was even promised? I don't know. It feels to me like something still needs to happen. There still needs to be some breakthroughs. And I wonder if you think, like, if you're optimistic about it, about VR in general, but also as an artist, the potential it has for you.
Yeah, I mean, look, good question. I think I'm sort of skeptical at the moment about it sort of becoming really a staple of home entertainment. I mean, like, to answer that previous question, like, no, I don't think it has sort of realized the promise that it had, but I think you'd have to look at like what promises were made and why they were made. A lot of the promises were made because people were investing in it and it was like a kind of hype sort of curve. You know, it's going to be like, you know, like millions in households or whatever. You know, you look at the kind of the numbers, and we were involved in VR back then in 2015, 2016 when, you know, and, you know, a lot has changed since then. I think, you know, and, you know, Meta are laying off people and stuff like that. And, you know, but there's also the Pico headset, you know, potentially Apple are going to be releasing something as well. There's still the Vive and at home stuff. I think it's a smaller market, obviously, but people were always kind of comparing it to, I don't know, okay, you're going to be doing it at home instead of watching TV or Netflix or whatever. And it just isn't that for me. For me, as an artist, I like it. I love the medium, but for it to really work, it has to be something that is constructed for a particular audience. So sure, like, you know, I can play a game on it and that's fine and I can do that. But if it comes to the sort of stuff that I'm trying to make, which I guess is a hybrid of like cinema, gaming and theater and stuff like that, it's like a kind of like an art form in itself, I guess, that uses multi-sensory techniques and all of that. You know, for me, the best way to show that is in a location-based sort of entertainment sense, is like, you know, I'm going to build it so that you can come and buy a ticket as you did. And then in terms of the quality of the experience, you're going to be led into that experience. And, you know, we're doing everything to guarantee that it works in the way that it should, to kind of almost show the capabilities of the medium. Because I think I think VR is, in terms of exhibition, is quite sort of mired in basically bad exhibiting protocols, like bad onboarding, bad like offboarding. You know, people that don't really understand the tech putting headsets on you, or like they haven't updated it, or there's so many things in terms of exhibiting it that can go wrong. It's kind of, you know, even, you know, Beats is, you know, there's a very fine line between it like running seamlessly and it completely crashing and being crap. And the pressure is, you know, when you're at home and something doesn't work, you can just like take it off, reboot it, do whatever. Like, you can't do that if everyone's coming in every hour and they've bought tickets for it. So yeah, you have to kind of work out systems to really like mitigate against that kind of stuff, because it can be a problem. And, you know, and things still obviously happen, but it's like, you know, for instance, like Meta did an update this week that is broken. And if you update all the headsets, it's not going to play. It's going to leave artifacts on, you know, like graphical artifacts. Apparently, you know, it's a known problem, but all the headsets auto update, you know, and then, but we've got all the headsets at fact, like off the internet. So they're not updating because you have to keep it almost isolated off the internet. So yeah, it's difficult, but I do believe that the future of VR, as far as I'm concerned, is creating experiences that are an appointment to view, where I can say, you've got this space, you've got the fans, you've got the sub pack, you've got all the lighting and all that kind of stuff, and to really take you into something and make it a really quality experience. At home, it's more difficult. It's more difficult because of space. It's more difficult because of life. You know, it's hard to, as we discussed earlier, like one of the beautiful things about VR is locking yourself into it and being like, right, I'm discarding everything else and I'm just doing this. There is, in a world where we are sort of kind of bombarded with stuff all the time and messages and this, that, and the other, it's like there's something almost sort of, you know, a sense of almost mental well-being to be able to kind of just focus on one thing for once. And it's very hard to do that at home, I think, you know. So I think that's why it's struggled. It's struggled because you don't want to put something on your head at home that stops you from kind of being able to do other stuff. In the same way as like people always like compare it to 3D TVs, like right at the beginning, oh, is it not the 3D TV? You know, and the problem with 3D TVs was always like, it's more hassle. If it's more hassle to watch a 3D TV than to watch a TV, then why would you do it for that advantage? You know, if it means that you can't actually look at your phone while you're watching something, you know, and you know, because that's what people do. So, yeah, in terms of like industry and headsets and where Meta are going, I mean, your guess is as good as mine, in that they don't really say very much and they're very hard to, you know, we find them very hard to contact, and it's hard to get them to actually watch content as well. They're very focused on selling headsets and that's it. And they're very sort of focused on sort of the gaming sort of community. And it's a little bit of a walled garden, really, I would say, like the Meta sort of ecosystem in terms of getting work like this onto their system. You know, and it's frustrating because we'd love to be on it, but you know, there are other platforms.
I guess that was one of the things that I felt really strongly from going to see your work, was as someone who'd experienced VR for, I think, only really for gaming purposes previously. I don't think I'd ever experienced, you know, a sort of artistic documentative piece like that. It really washed away some skepticism I had. And I can imagine people who are unsure about, you know, what, you know, VR can do, or maybe they don't really understand how it works, they can go and experience your work and similar pieces of art, and it can maybe make something click in their heads. Do you feel like this approach to designing art using this medium, really harnessing VR to make these experiences for people, actually can progress the, you know, the VR art form and can make it I don't know, more popular and give it the breakthroughs that the at-home stuff isn't doing. Like, it could be a more accepted way of experiencing just life and culture if we have more stuff like what you put together.
Yeah, I think so. I generally do think so. I think the nature of how Beats is designed in terms of its free roaming elements means that there isn't really a sort of kind of barrier as much to entry to it. It's very simple in many ways because you know how to move around a space, and you know, and the only real sort of kind of thing is like picking stuff up, which is just a trigger. So it's quite easy.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, we made the piece fully accessible, so you can do it sitting down in a wheelchair. If you know, you can use the controls to move around the space, and you know, kind of ironically, the more accessible version that we made is actually in a way less accessible to the average person, because you have to teach them how to use a teleport function, which is like, you know, it's a gaming kind of thing. You know, it's just like, so if you get somebody, you know, it'd be like kind of trying to sit somebody down in front of a PlayStation and go, okay, well, this is how you do this, and just expecting them to get it really quick. So I feel like, you know, free roaming is really important. And there are limits to that in terms of being able, the headset being able to track in space, you know. But, you know, one of the main issues, you know, from an artistic point of view and developing the medium is getting the funding to do it. You know, it's ever-changing landscape. Things like, you know, Meta laying off people is a problem. And it, we've seen lots of people come into the industry and leave the industry because of the lack of funding or the lack of audience and stuff like that. And so there are a lot of actually really good VR makers, artists in the UK making work. People like Marshmallow Laser Feast, Anagram are another really like amazing group of makers. And I guess the thing about them and us as well, like myself and East City Films, is that we've stuck at it and we're still doing it 8 years later. And trying to get sort of beyond this idea that it's just a new medium. And so, like, in terms of funding, it should always go to like new voices in the medium, who inevitably, you know, that is important, but also they're always going to start from the beginning again. You know, like, what does this medium do? Like, ask the same questions that we asked 8 years ago. Yeah. And I think what you see in Beats, in Pursuit of Repetitive Beats, is somebody that's been working in the medium for a while now and has sort of kind of answered a lot of those questions around how to design an experience, a narrative experience that works in a certain way. And so, sure, like the next thing that I do, like every time I get the opportunity to make something or get funding to make something, I have to put it all, I have to go all in. You know, it's like everything that I think like I'm trying to do or I've learned is going into that piece of work. And then the next time is like, okay, how much further can I go? Like where, what worked, what didn't work? Where do we take it? And I think that's really, really important, but it's obviously quite challenging given sort of the arts funding landscape and how competitive that is. And also, you know, there isn't a great deal of money out there to make these sort of kind of pieces really. The other thing is, you know, you'll see obviously at the moment in terms of immersive events, you know, the amount of immersive things that are on are, there's loads, but a lot of it is projection mapping and stuff like that, you know, like the Van Gogh and the Frida Kahlo and stuff like that. And, you know, that's really because that can be mass audience, whereas VR can't, it just inherently can't be that. And so that's a problem that we're sort of kind of dealing with. And I think actually having made Beats the way that we made it, we are learning through exhibiting it, like what are the commercial limits of it as well. So, you know, so part of me is like, okay, I'm just an artist and I want to make something in this medium and it's all about the medium. And then you get to the end of that and you're trying to put it into the gallery. And they're like, well, we're going to give you the space for like a month, but only 8 people can do it at a time. And so suddenly you're faced with the kind of commercial sort of problems about it.
Yeah.
And then that starts to feed back into your art sort of practice. So you start to think, well, okay, how do I make something where, I don't know, instead 25 people can do it at the same time? But what will it lose as an art form if that happens? If, you know, or how do you protect the art form by realizing that there is a need to make it at least a little bit more sort of kind of communal, I guess.
Yeah,
so, I mean, lots of questions. You know, it's like, you know, we're constantly talking about this, constantly thinking about it, and also trying to then devise new work that is of interest to me. You know, often, like, you know, people, as I said at the beginning, people were saying, well, you know, what music genres can you do? It's like, I don't necessarily go from one piece of work and go, right, I've done rave music, now I'm going to do, you know, I don't know, like punk, or now I'm going to go and do like a reggae piece, or, you know, that's not how really I work. Like, I want to do something. I kind of find projects in different ways. Like, the project before Beats was about regeneration on the largest housing estate in Europe. So it's completely different, but like, music's actually still played quite a big role in it. So in terms of some of the sequences and stuff like that. So it's, yeah, it's an interesting problem, but it's a good problem to have in the sense of, like, you know, I feel good that I've stuck at it, you know, and that's great.
I think one of the things you can't help but think about as an audience member when you're in when you're watching In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats, and I guess people who have experienced your previous work feel the same way, is how these things come to be, because you can tell when you're, you know, without sort of ruining the story too much, you know, you're moving through different spaces that represent actual real life spaces, but then you're also going through more abstract spaces that are kind of imagined and are more like symbolic of you know, rave feeling and music, and they go into, like, I don't know, trance style nether regions at points. But then you're also experiencing the testimonials of real people via very creative ways. And you can't help but think, right, so there's been a lot of research. There's obviously been a lot of, like, design work, and there would have been actors involved, and there's been shots done in cars. I just was wondering the scale of it, the time that went into it, the number of people that go into it. How do you make something like that come to be?
Well, it's certainly the biggest project that we've done to date in terms of the scale of the production and the people involved. I mean, the research is the major thing for me. Like, I get really sort of into that and designing stuff and working with a creative technologist at a company called All Seeing Eye called Ollie Lindsay, who we just get on very, very well in terms of we're both into kind of similar things. So, you know, we'll spend ages looking at what type of shoes should be in the bedroom and in the corner, you know, Reebok Classics. But then, you know, I discovered that there are two different types of soles of Reebok Classics, and I wanted these particular ones. Well, what the stereo is going to be was based on the Technics stereo that I had. And, like, so all these kind of different things, you know, there's even, like, hidden sort of nods in there. The fact that it's like a Peugeot 205 is actually a nod to Coventry's industrial past, because Coventry was the place where Peugeot was built in the UK, you know, so that's why it's a Peugeot and not a Volvo or like a Ford Escort, you know, stuff like that. You know, you mentioned like the kind of Tron sort of kind of stuff. It's actually, that whole scene is based on flyer artwork. So you're in the Dreamscape flyer, which is the green grid. There's right. The Amnesia. Wow. So those flyers are outside in the exhibition. So, you know, when you're passing through people, that's from a flyer and stuff like that. So people that really sort of love that stuff, you know, that, for me, that's the joy. I love, like, making stuff like that and going, right, I'm going to do this whole piece about getting to the rave in a convoy is going to be set in flyer artwork, you know, and then you go off and kind of make that. So everything in there has been sort of I'd say painstakingly researched, I would like, to a nerdy, stupid degree, really.
One of my favorite bits of it was, and yeah, without ruining it too much, like, you end up in a rave around lots of people, and there weren't like stock characters all sort of bouncing at the same time, doing the same thing. You look around and everyone's doing their own thing. Like, it's a real, it's like you're in a real room.
That was
their own dance move.
Yeah, that was a real, a real decision that was made as well. Like, I wanted to, that randomness. I wanted it to feel like that. I mean, one of the things that we did to test, you do a lot of testing and iterations. And one of the things that we did was we made a 360 version of that in that space in video. And we did get some like Shutterstock or like Pond5, like silhouette party stock footage, you know, so it was just a silhouette. So, and it's like this, and, you know, we put it in there just to see what, you know, just to see what would happen and see what it looked like. And, you know, one of the first things that just stood out to me was like the repeating of moves. So it was just like someone sticking their arm in the air and it's like, woo, like that. And then it would come back again. And you, like, as soon as you see something that is repeated in the same way, you know, instantly. Absolutely. So the way that we did that piece, and this is in the making of as well, and in the second part, is that we did a motion capture session with two dancers, and I sent them lots of archive of people dancing at raves in the late 80s and the 90s, and we looked at these different dance moves, and then we recorded motion capture of them doing about 10 different dance intensity. So intensity 1, 2, 3, and, you know, intensity 1 was like, you know, I'm just a bit like wasted and I'm just kind of bobbing my head and I'm still kind of, you know. So intensity 10, which is like really going for it, like throwing like arms in the air and just kind of like really, but also kind of making sure that we were doing it to the right music, so we were playing the music in the session as well. And we did that both in an asymmetrical way and a symmetrical sort of dance moves for a male dancer and a female dancer. And then from that, I selected probably about 6 or 7 or maybe more like loops. And then we put that into that scene and let those characters, all those models in there, like access those different loops, kind of randomized sort of pattern. So that the effect is that, you know, you feel like, oh, everyone's just kind of like doing their own thing. Which is what I remember, you know, that scene. I, you know, I think what I said is that when I was doing that stuff, I remember not really seeing very clearly anything. You would see like bits of arm and legs, or like a strobe would go off, and you'd just see like kind of fragments of people. And that's the effect that I wanted. And sometimes actually the more that you show in VR, the worse it is. There's this idea that even in the bedroom at the beginning, you know, the more sort of realistic we made it in terms of graphics, the less real it felt. And then when we decided, actually, let's bring it back, we put like a kind of like a VHS sort of kind of filter over stuff, which is really hard to do in 3D because you have to, you know, a slight offset on things, that it started to feel more realistic because it felt more like your memory of what that place was like. It was kind of trying to get to an aesthetic that, if I went up into my loft now and got pictures out of old pictures out of a box of me and my mate sitting around in my mate Tom's house, which is the house that we always went to, his bedroom, sofa, you know, spliffs and all that kind of stuff and PlayStation 1s, you know, that's the kind of feel that it would have. So I want to, and that's why those people that we captured volumetrically are frozen in time. They're sort of tableaus.
Yeah.
If we started to make them moving, firstly, there's a cost implication of that, a really quite a high cost implication of doing volumetric video. Secondly, once you do volumetric video, there is a sort of like uncanny valley vibe to it. It's kind of like, oh, you know, so having people sort of kind of posed in a sort of vignette or a tableau of like position kind of almost speaks more of what was, you know, captures more of the essence of what I was trying to go for, which is like, it's a memory. It's this kind of warm feeling. So it's like there's a whole kind of suite of different sort of kind of techniques that you can use, but then you're kind of then refining it to go for the ones that you feel are going to best represent what you're trying to say. And sometimes going for the most expensive, the most, the best, you know, thing is not the right way to go, really, you know.
You said nostalgia or nostalgic earlier, and I think that was the thing I was really, really surprised by, was as someone who wasn't living through that time, wasn't old enough to go to, I wasn't born, to be honest, in 1989, but I'm not from Coventry. And to be able to feel a sense of such deep empathy with the people in the virtual people in that piece, but also the real people whose stories are anecdotally told within the piece, and to feel like I was yearning for this time that I never got to experience myself was really, really, really powerful. And I felt like there was something about the medium that was allowing me to hit that emotional register. I guess when you are watching a film, maybe something in your head tells you that, you know, it's still a screen, or it's something that's been, it's been recorded elsewhere. But when you are sort of like people looking you in the eyes, when you're in your VR headset in and you kind of can turn away or you can look at them, it's much harder to avoid, like, the emotional depths that I think you're being thrown into. And I wondered if you felt like VR and rave were kind of destined to sort of form this collaboration, and this piece would only work with that kind of genre of music, or you think that this is something that, like, it's a very tactile experience going to a rave, and dance music is very, the bass hits you quite deep. Do you think that you could, you know, talk about other musical scenes or moments through the same medium? Is it something about VR?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're talking at the moment about doing, like, people keep asking me, you know, like, what genre are you going to do next, kind of thing? What moment are you going to do next? I think it's important, though, that there is some sort of journey in it. Like, you know, there's a pilgrimage of some sort. And that doesn't necessarily mean, like, literally, like, you know, we're going to Woodstock or whatever. It's like there has to be something that encapsulates a time, an environment, a sense of what was special about that time and place. And you set the story within that. You know, and then within that, you can kind of explore so many different sort of cultures, music, genres, all sorts of different things. I think one of the reasons that I love the medium in VR, and I've been working in it for about 8 years now, since about 2014, is that I do love the sort of the way that you can tell a story and you can really connect emotionally with it. I think that it's something really, I think, to do with the medium itself. And actually, some of the things that, again, are sometimes sticks to beat it with are, like, you know, it's a little bit sort of, you know, you've got to kind of, as an audience member, you have to kind of commit, really. You know, you go in there, you're asked to put on a vest, you're asked to put on a headset, headphones, all this stuff, you know, and there is a bit of rigmarole to actually get going, but once you're going, you kind of cut yourself off from everything else, and that sort of kind of isolation within the experience itself, I think, means that audience members end up giving more of themselves to it. And that sort of connection that you have is kind of a subjective narrative that you start to kind of bring into the experience. You start to kind of relate the stories to your own life, because I feel that you feel like a deeper connection. You don't have the outside world sort of feeding you with, I don't know, like social media or tweets or news or whatever. You're just you in that space. And I think that's really important. There's also, in terms of, like, the immersive nature of it and the fidelity of the environments, the fact that you can pick up stuff and that you can, that things are responsive, I think gives you a sense of memory from it. You know, instead of just like, oh, I remember watching that, I remember doing that is what VR does. I remember picking that up. I remember walking across the radio tuner and tuning it. And so those interactions have a quality to them that kind of rewards you a little bit. It's like, oh, I've discovered this thing, and I get a little burst of, like, you know, endorphin.
Yeah.
And I have a memory of it, and it kind of, it's almost like, you know, it's like a montage of memory moments within an experience. So I think it kind of, like, really deepens that connection for audience members. You know, when it's done correctly, there's so many things making VR that can really pull people out of the experience. And so part of the, I guess, the creative process and the directorial process of it is trying to make sure that all the elements that you're putting in there are all going to work and give people a experience that they can get lost in. I think for me, like, I often say this to people, it's just like, for me, it's like, and I've done lots of VR and other loads of VR festivals and stuff, and, you know, and often VR can be quite disappointing. And, you know, but once you put on the headset, you sort of almost walk through a door into an experience. And for me, if you still 2 minutes in feel like, or 5 minutes into my experience, feel like you still can know where that door is that you walked into, then it's sort of like failed. What I want you to do is, like, walk through that door and then get completely lost in it. So you don't know where you are anymore and you're just there, you know? So it's like, if you just feel that you could take off the headset at any point, you know, or just press pause, then it's not really working. So, yeah, it's so I think, you know, to answer your question better, I think the medium itself is very much one that allows audiences to connect to a deeper sort of emotional resonance, really. With,
and I was just thinking, there's an interesting parallel between the act of going to a rave as a story you tell, which is, you know, you go to a secret place, you and your friends don't know everyone there, you don't know where it is, and then there's experience enhancing drugs being taken. It's all about, you know, transcending your normal life, your daily life. And I guess there's an interesting parallel between going through a VR experience and what people were trying to achieve by going to raves in the period of time that you're unlocking and you're documenting.
Yeah, absolutely. In a weird way, and I've said this before, it's like it's kind of using a lot of technology to get you back to a sort of more organic, sort of connective state. You know, it's about connecting with real people. And one of the things I was going to say, you know, obviously, you know, as you said, it's set in Coventry, but I was pretty clear with the people that commissioned it, Coventry City of Culture, that even though I would set it in Coventry, that it was really a UK story. So I think that's why, sort of, certainly with UK audiences, it resonates, because it could be set in Milton Keynes, it could be set in Blackburn, it could be set in Manchester or, like, Leeds or wherever, you know. It could be, you know, I think originally I was going to do it about, because I'm London based, like, about the Orbital sort of rave. So, you know, but the fact of the matter is that people from London traveled to Birmingham and Coventry to go out.
Have you found that this has had a lot of popularity in Coventry? Do you feel like this is contributing to an overall cultural appreciation for Coventry that wasn't there before? How does it kind of align with the goals of the 2021 project? And, you know, have you been able to sort of appreciate that impact?
I think Coventry as a city feels like it, they feel like they're underrepresented in terms of that rave story. So there was always a sort of, from them, I guess, a slight resentment that when rave music and acid house music's talked about, and you know, there's lots of documentaries about it and lots of films made about it, they never really get a mention. And actually, they were really integral to that scene, in that early scene. You know, they were kind of, Amnesia House were pioneers, and they were just, but they didn't really know that they were pioneers, and you know, they just went out and did it. Because it was something that they wanted to do, but because they weren't really business people in the sort of kind of in the sense that we understand it, like, their story has kind of almost been forgotten.
in favor of the story of Manchester and Hacienda and London and all those kind of. So it's been really good to be able to tell that story for them, and at least sort of kind of allow people to sort of enjoy what is, I guess, a universal story of UK rave, but like set it in that place and give a nod to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel the Coventry Culture Trust is going through a tough time with financial sort of difficulties this year. And it's probably really important that like the work and the achievements of that project and its impact is still sort of like celebrated and amplified, even though, you know, it actually only took place a couple of years ago. And there's got to be that kind of enduring effect of the work that went into the City of Culture needs to sort of be recognised. And I guess that's one of the nice things about me going to all the way over to Liverpool to experience the performance is that I realised that this was something that, you know, was about Coventry and a piece brought together to celebrate Coventry. And you know, that sort of speaks to the the effect that such pieces can have.
Yeah, I mean, that's really good. I mean, it only premiered in Coventry like a year ago, so it's only just been just over a year, again, because of the COVID stuff. But yeah, obviously, since then, you know, I think there's... I think from their point of view is, you know, working with kind of arts funding and stuff like that, you know, they often want... The thing that they want most is audiences, and they want, you know, when they fund something and they want a legacy and for a project. And often I guess that doesn't necessarily happen. And I think, you know, what you're alluding to with Coventry City of Culture and like money and the legacy that was meant to happen in the city with that's at the moment been sort of that's in trouble. So it is nice that this project has been able to travel. And the thing about VR as well is that as you was when you were doing it, you know, the throughput of how many people can do it is very small. So, you know, we're talking at max capacity, 80 people a day. So, you know, and that's the nature of the experience, you know, but for that, you get a really intense experience that you remember. Whereas, you know, maybe if it was a different sort of installation where, you know, you could get like hundreds of people through, but it might leave less of an impression. So I think it's great that we're able to tour it, and we're going to continue to tour it. And I think that it's great for that particular story for sure.
And that was Darren Emerson speaking to the State of the Arts about his incredible immersive artwork in pursuit of repetitive beats. Thanks so much, Darren, for taking time to talk to us about his work and about VR and art in general. Make sure you keep an eye out for more from Darren and his production company, East City Films. And be sure to check out In Pursuit of Repetitive Beats when it tours near you. I promise you, you don't want to miss it. Thanks for listening to another episode of the State of the Arts podcast. And remember to head to our site for more content about exciting stuff happening in arts and culture today.